Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
So I'm John Teeter, and I'm a church planting pastor in West Long Beach, Fountain of Life Covenant Church, and for the last 3 years I've also led church planting for the Covenant denomination.
I'm Dan Rodriguez. I'm one of the ministers at the Hollywood Church of Christ in Los Angeles, and I'm also a professor of missions at Pepperdine University in Malibu. I live there in the barrio. I live in the barrio of Malibu. I live on campus. I live on campus, faculty housing. And Southern California is my home, born and raised here. Anybody here not from Southern California, raise your hand. Okay, for those of you not from Southern California, sorry about the weather. It's usually a lot nicer than this.
Hi, my name is Noemi Chavez. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and pastor alongside my husband here at 7th Street Church in Long Beach. And yeah, excited to be here and to connect with you guys.
Hola, me llamo Joshua Chavez. We are church planting pastors in East Long Beach. We love John Teeter. There's definitely a lot of love for the city of Long Beach. We're excited and honored to be here with you guys, and hoping for a great time over the next few minutes.
So what I want to do is just start kind of give us a few thoughts to open up. And then in a sense, like, let's just pretend for the next – yeah, thank you for shutting the door, bro. Maybe for the next 20, 25 minutes or so, I've invited my friends to my house, and this is my living room, okay? And you guys get to be flies on the wall, all right? And you get to listen in on our conversation. So maybe for the first 20, 25 minutes, we'll have a little discussion here, okay? And then we'll open it up for any thoughts or questions that you want to have and jump into the conversation. That sound good? So that's what we do. So let me just kind of, like, talk to my friends over at my house. We're having a couple beers. I think Covenant folks can do that, right? Yeah, so anyway.
Pietists.
Yeah,
Pietists.
That's right. This is kind of as I've been thinking about all the issues and, you know, for years, of course, and even the most recent last few, really starting with Ferguson as a ramp up in our more modern days, you know, I'm thinking that never before in my lifetime, I'm 54 years old, has the people of our country been so at odds with one another. And it's not like there's not been problems, of course, right? But it feels as if the problems were always, like, confined to, like, one or two things at a time. You know, like, one or two issues. Today, it's like no matter where you turn, no matter what the issue, race, class, culture, gender, religion, politics, even whether to sit, stand, or kneel on the national anthem, everybody is opposed. It's just polarization, painful polarization, division, no matter where you turn on every front. Everybody's bowed up, you know, just arguing at each other's throats, we know, on all these issues. So that kind of climate in my lifetime, Daniel, we're probably closer in age than these guys, but
no,
you might say,
guy. I'm an old guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, so we got this painful polarization and division. And having said that, it makes me think, like, particularly for the multi-ethnic church, which is what we advocate, multi-ethnic, economically diverse churches for the sake of the gospel, I'm thinking this should be the church's finest hour, right? In fact, our national conference, our theme is our finest hour. Like, you know, is it not for such a time as this that God has, over the past 15, 20 years, raised up a growing movement of churches to become a credible witness of God's love for all people, to advance faith, peace, hope, and love in this world that's looking for that. And they have no answers, as you know. You watch CNN, Fox. Whenever these discussions come up, people talk and talk, and then at the end of the day, they go, what do we do? Like, nobody knows what to do, right? And all that, and yet we have the answer. So, but of course, that's where the problem lies, right? Is that due to the systemic segregation of the local church, we have virtually zero credibility on one of the top, maybe two, single greatest issues of our time. And so while the American church, you know, continues to chase and fawn over all things missional, the single greatest polarization issue we have in our society is all things racial, right? And so having said that, it should be our finest hour, but it's not because of systemic segregation. So what that feels like to me is that, you know, that we're in the back of this huge line that's going forward. We're in the back, and we're going, hey, everybody get along. Hey, everybody have peace. But we don't have peace because it's a white church, black church, you know, Asian church, rich church, poor church. So we don't model that, and therefore we're not out front and on top in language, so we have to use the language of the world. So we end up being as polarized as the society in our churches because we have to talk about Black Lives Matter or All Lives Matter or this or that, and we don't have we should be framing the conversation. Sure. We should be leading the charge, but due to our systemic segregation, we're not, and no one's listening. And so, you know, you watch CNN, Fox, MSNBC, et cetera, and an issue happens, let's say, like here in San Diego, the guy that you know, just was recently shot, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name.
Alfred.
I'm sorry?
Alfred Olango.
Alfred Olango, believe it or not, he goes to a multi, his sister and brother would go to a multi-ethnic church, and a buddy that was here yesterday, he's doing the funeral Saturday. I got the script. He sent it to me last night to edit. Wow. For the funeral. He's in a multi-ethnic church. There's big name pastors in San Diego, the NAACP, they passed them all up to go to him. His church is like 150 people. This is how it should be, right? But it's not, and all this. So all that's to say is that we are not framing the discussion, shaping the narrative. And when you go to these TV and all that, they ask politicians, they ask educators, they ask sports figures. Everybody has a seat at the table to try to make sense of all this pain and division. When was the last time you saw a pastor invited even to have a seat at the table? We don't even get invited. We are nowhere on the radar because of our systemic segregation. So, to me, it seems this should be our finest hour. And of course, the question it begins with building healthy multi-ethnic churches, but it doesn't stop there. That's the foundation. So, that's just kind of some thoughts to get your minds wrapped around this. What are some of your reactions or thoughts about some of those things that I'm saying or what you're seeing?
First of all, thank you, Mark, for inviting us to be a part of this. And I think, just looking at this panel, it's clear other voices are missing. So this isn't, and even if we had, you know, more ethnic diversity here, we're probably still missing socioeconomic diversity, which all of us know is maybe a bigger challenge for us. And to a large extent, that's what's driving a lot of the racial problems, is socioeconomic imbalances. But we clearly live in a racialized society, as Michael Emerson says. You can't really explain what's going on in our world, in our society, without recognizing the impact that race has had. And while many people will nod their head to that, we also have another reality we're dealing with, and that is for many people, especially in the dominant group, we're seeing race fatigue. It's like, we're talking about race again? And that is a challenge, especially when they're Christians who have something to say. When we're speaking on behalf of the King, we have something to say about race. We have good news about race problems in our society. I think one of the biggest challenges we have, besides race fatigue, we think that, you know, we're tired of hearing about it, or we think that we really shouldn't be talking about it. Some believe, but talking about it makes it worse. And, you know, you know, as soon as I see students, even at Pepperdine, as soon as something is mentioned about, you know, Black Lives Matter, the eyes roll, and, you know, they want to change the channel or change the topic of discussion. The race fatigue is there, which is interesting because race is not going away. We have a problem we have to deal with. I think one reason we don't speak enough to it, maybe I'm confessing here, why I don't speak more loudly, more publicly on this, blogging or tweeting about some of these things. I do once in a while, but I know part of it is fear. I think part of the reason maybe that we're not contributing to the conversation what we can contribute is we're afraid. I mean, we live in a digital society. We live in a society where something you say right now, I mean, somebody's probably recording this right now. So I say something stupid, it's going to be on YouTube.
It's happening.
And so, you know, we're afraid of making a mistake, being that person that people are talking about. And so fear is, I think, a challenge, among others. I'll just stop there. Those are just a couple of quick responses, and maybe that resonates with other people in the group.
I think one of the other issues is, as Mark is saying, the segregated church. As church planters, we need to think about what kind of church we want and what kind of church God's calling you to. So I actually became a Christian here in Los Angeles in 1992, the week of the Rodney King riots. And as I became a Christian, I felt it was part of my destiny to bring socioeconomic and racial issues together, class and culture. 20 years later, 15 years later, my wife and I are being assessed, and we're in this project where you have to think about, in a greater metropolitan, if you're going to plant a church that will plant 10 churches in this neighbor, you know, this greater city, what will you do? And all four other couples immediately said, well, where's the wealthiest, the boom, where can we go, where are the leaders? And we said, whoa, where's Luke 4? So Luke 4, the Spirit of the Lord is on Jesus, anointing him to preach good news to the poor. First century Mediterranean culture, poor is five status qualities, so it's very Asian. It's all status. You either didn't have enough money, you're poor, couldn't afford the R, you're po.
You're so poor, you can't.
Yeah, someone texted me from my church and said, no, that's poo. you're the wrong gender. You're the wrong race. You have health issues, or you have an immoral occupation. And Jesus said, that's where you should plant the church. And what are the two examples he gives? It's Naaman the Syrian that Elijah ministers to, and the widow from Zarephath. Two Gentiles, but two classes as well. So I think the problem is there aren't enough multi-ethnic, multi-class churches. That's the design of the New Testament, and we settle for the low-hanging fruit. So our credibility is wiped out. You're not even having reconciliation in your own church.
You know, several weeks ago when the awakening of Black Lives Matter resurfaced, because it didn't just start, it's been going for some time, we pastor a multi-ethnic church in the city of Long Beach that's as diverse as the city. And so we had an opportunity to turn the cheek, you know, and I believe in silent witnesses being as guilty as the one committing the crime, right? Like, I saw the crime, but I didn't want to say anything about it. So, and my heart was just so troubled. I remember sitting at home and just watching the YouTube videos and you know, everybody's just angry. And then within the hour, I started seeing the complete opposite reaction from people. You know, all of a sudden, this idea of all lives matter started to surfacing up. And I'm just sitting here at home with the tension. Like, I had already drafted my post. I had already selected the pictures. And I literally sat there with my finger on my phone. I know the moment I hit send, something's up, you know. And I hit send, and I'm gonna confess something. Like, I just left my phone alone. I didn't even want to go on social media to see who was commenting, who was liking. And to my surprise, the pushback and even the attack that I got, because I was standing alongside a group of people who at that given moment needed to be affirmed, prayed for, loved, looked at. And as a pastor of a multi-ethnic church with African-American brothers and sisters that God has trusted us to lead to Jesus, these are my spiritual children. I have a responsibility as a spiritual father to say, I agree that all lives matter, but right now that's not the issue. That's not what we're talking about. And so, you know, I remember this verse in the book of Micah, chapter 6 and verse 8. You know, the Lord has shown us what the good thing is, and it is to do justice and to love. And what sacrifices are we willing to make to lead the conversation at this very fine hour? To lead the conversation in reconciliation and restoration. And I guess the bigger question for us as pastors and as leaders is, what sacrifice are we willing to make? And the reason why I stood there for a long time was not that the thought crossed my mind, like who will stop coming to my church? I never thought that. But to my surprise, the worst thing that I probably could have imagined didn't happen. You know, and I had the beautiful opportunity to affirm and stand alongside some people that I genuinely love.
Those are obviously great thoughts with that. And both, you know, Daniel and Josh, you know, you mentioned this idea of speaking and saying. And there's, when I think about this stuff and listening to everybody right now and those thoughts, I think there are a couple problems that we have, because lots of people, like, we know what to do, or we know what we want to do, or we want to affirm this, but actually gaining measurable traction and bringing change, like, how does that not happen? So I think two kind of things. Let me throw this out to you. At once, there is both the individual and the collective, right? And of course, white people, which I am in America, we tend to think, because of history in America, and we've been allowed to be individualistic, manifest destiny for ourselves, where people of color haven't had that. But white people in general tend to see things individually, right? So when the thing happened to Ferguson, Michael Brown, in general, white people look at that and go, well, you know, he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have. Yeah, what are the facts? He shouldn't have gone in. He shouldn't have harassed the store owner or whatever, all the different things. And as if it's a one-off, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the African-American community and other minority communities, they see it collectively. That Michael Brown was me. That's us. It's not that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's me. And I think part of the problem of the discussion of race in America and the continued painful polarization on social media and just, you know, whatever, is because at once somebody's talking individual and somebody's talking collective, and people can't, they don't think with nuance, right? I look in America, it seems like our whole society has lost the ability to speak with nuance and even to understand nuance. Like, again, individual and collective, it's both and, not either or, right? And to think with nuance. So, for instance, I don't get into politics, et cetera, and all that. I've literally got the Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid of the state of Arkansas, has been a member of my church for 10 years, African-American woman. She's the leader of the Senate. As liberal can be, but she loves the Lord. She's been a faithful member of my church for 10 years. Then I got Asa Hutchinson, Republican governor, who I got white appointee of the governor, and they walk, work, and worship God together as one big happy family. We tell our church, hey, fight it out in the streets, outside those doors.
Good.
It's your right. Some would say it's your responsibility, right? So, but in here, the cross, and we check our politics, not our culture, but definitely we check our politics at the door. So, but anyway, I'm saying this idea of nuance and people, the inability to think with it, this individual collective thing is there, and we need to know that. But for instance, in politics today, you can't say, well, I like Donald Trump because he's, I think it just came out the list, he's like the 21st or 65th richest person. He's got wealth, and it's on the Forbes magazine, and he signed the front of a paycheck. But I don't like him on all these other things. You can't say that. It's either one or the other. You're either for him or Hillary Clinton, the same thing, right? People can't split hairs like that. They can't say, well, I like her for this, but I don't like her for that. Right? Because you're held, it's either one or the other. And that's just politics. But on all these different fronts, Black Lives Matter. You're either with us or you're not. All Blue Lives Matter. You're either with us or you're not. It seems like our society has lost the ability to think with nuance, to speak with nuance, and ultimately we are called to be peacemakers. So I literally just did, I'll finish with this thought, I did an interview with a researcher out here just a few hours ago, and he talked to me about speaking, the very thing, like not speaking up is silence, and I'm like, I got a little bit different take on that. And here's what it is, because what's wrong about silence is when there's no action. Think about that, right? So remember, isn't it St. Francis of Assisi? He didn't say it, but he gets attributed to it. You know, preach the gospel and when necessary, use words. Okay, so the idea of being silent is if there's no action, then yes, you're complicit. But sometimes, like, I don't speak to a lot of issues, but our church acts and it does things. I would never say this, like, you know, let's go on. So the point is that our actions, isn't that the old phrase, your actions speak louder than words? Well, everybody wants to talk, but very few have the action of justice in the street, economic development, bringing diverse people together. So our words fall on deaf ears. And is this not what it means to be noisy gongs and clanging cymbals? So when I'm silent on a lot of issues that I see other pastor friends speaking out on, I'm not complicit because the actions of my church, the measurable improvements that we're doing in the community and that is recognized widely, is speaking on my behalf. But silence without action, that's complicity. And that, again, is a nuance, right, to be able to split that hair and understand. So, trying to sow peace, that and so I already said, just like a good preacher is my final thought. Here's the deal. If the day after, like I have not, like just in politics, which involves a lot of race right now, right, and in class and culture, I see people, you know, really a lot of evangelical pastors just slamming on Donald Trump, right, and they are not with Trump at all and all that, and for all the reasons we know why, we know. But here's the deal. I don't slam on Trump no more than I slam on Hillary. I don't support Trump no more than I support Hillary because the day after that election, I have to pastor 50% of the electorate. See what I'm saying? And I tweeted somewhere out, there are going to be a lot of pastors down the road with complete egg on their face. I don't care who wins. And Billy Graham learned this. He supported Nixon, and there you go. And he said, I'm not getting in politics anymore. We are supposed to pastor all people. So as much as I might be personally offended by a bunch of stuff, I got to remember the day after that election, half my body is going to be, there's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth in the streets, and I got to pastor them because I'm called to be a pastor of all people. I think it's a mistake, that, again, without nuance, to dive into some of this stuff because it's going to bite you in the butt on the back end, and we have to be there for all people. So how do we navigate nuance? How do we speak and sow peace into the polarizing conversations? You know, not easy. Action is a part of that.
So much like, I think what Josh shared, and even this whole idea of whether we respond or not with verbal proclamations on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, you know, our church has decided, like, just like you, we don't necessarily take a political stance, but we let our congregation and what we do envision for the city tell the story of what we stand for. And that's why I actually preached the Sunday when this whole situation with Black Lives Matter, Joshua was one of the situations. He was out of town, so I was speaking that Sunday, and I addressed it. I know.
Perfect timing.
And I addressed it with our congregation, and I really felt it's such a safe place. When your congregation knows that they are loved and championed by the leadership of the church, when they see that the leadership is not only diverse, but believe in its community and what we're doing to serve the underprivileged, the people who are in a really difficult place, the fatherless, the motherless. So when we have the conversation about race, I didn't feel any fear. I wasn't nervous about bringing it up in my church. I felt like if it was the safest place, I said, listen, if there's anywhere I could talk about this, it's here. Because here is the answer to the world. I said, look around you. Look at your brothers and sisters. Look at what the world needs. It's happening in this house. And so it's happening because we're doing exactly what John said. That Luke 4, understanding that if we serve and we are there for the least of these, when we are there to clothe the poor and feed the hungry, that creates this foundation for our church that gives us credibility in our community. And so when these hard conversations come to play, they're not hard for us. And I love reading the things that, like, Eugene Cho was posting, because he was really calling this all out as pastors, saying, like, hey, if you don't address this in your church, then it's pretty shameful. Like, in your position as a leader, address these conversations. I wasn't afraid to have that conversation. I wasn't afraid to bring it up because the church, the local church that we're pastoring, represents the kingdom of God, and it represents an answer to society. It represents an answer to the chaos that was out in the world. The house of God became the safe place for all peoples. It was amazing. Like, I see it every Sunday, but that Sunday it felt like, man, we are brothers and sisters here. And despite the chaos that's taking place on television and on social media, our safe place has not become a shameful place. It's become a place that celebrates the answer God has for our nation. And, you know, that's created for us not only credibility in our city, in our community, with the people who attend our church, but it's created a sense of credibility with people in authority in our church. And that's really important to us, that from, you know, the police and probation and judges of our city understand that's a safe place. That's a place that represents a church that is really making it a focus to reach people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all socioeconomic statuses. So, you know, I definitely got more heat on Facebook for my post than I did in my church for our conversation there. You know, and it was really, for me, it was affirming. Even though I felt safe, what was even more amazing was the affirmation I got from the people who came to my church after that Sunday, who said, "Pastor, we are so proud that you would bring this up. We champion what you're saying, and we validate that as a congregation." And here's the thing is that I did not only do that in our English congregation, I did it in our Spanish church. Like, I called out my Spanish people for the times that if they've ever had any conversations where they have been outlandishly racist in their words. I said, "Listen, we are the body of Christ, and we do not only pastor a Spanish-speaking church. We pastor a very multi-ethnic church in this building, and the pastors that you have as leaders honor people from all walks of life and all ethnic backgrounds and all socioeconomic status. So really educating even the Latino community about who we are as a church and what we stand for." Because anytime you get a group of people who are together from one ethnicity, you start to sense, but we break down those walls constantly in the conversations that we have with our Spanish congregation as well.
Well, let me just share that maybe your multi-ethnic church didn't respond if you responded like Noemi and Josh's congregation. Our congregation, Hollywood, had a different response as the leaders, and particularly me and my son, part of the leadership team, you know, made some very strong statements to our church and, you know, on our social media sites. And it was very interesting, the response. I was surprised. There were people in the dominant group who, too, decided to leave. They just said, "You know what? This is way too political." I didn't think what I said was political. Way too political. And we just want you to preach the gospel and why you get involved in this stuff. And it was the kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And I was shocked. And then there was a letter I received just going on and on about the horrible things that I have done in politicizing the gospel. On the other hand, there was, I think, one in particular, because she's so vocal, an African-American girl in our church, a young woman in her late 30s. And she was angry that we didn't go far enough. And she says, "You know, when this happens, I have to go to one of the historic black churches in town. I need to go to a place where I'm totally affirmed and where we're really dealing with this issue." And so you have to know that there's a really strong possibility in a multi-ethnic church that you're going to make everybody angry. that is a possibility. It could turn out as this situation did, but our situation didn't turn out that way. And so some were angry because I went too far, and some were angry because I didn't go far enough. That's a possibility. So let me just say very briefly what I think we try to do, what we try to speak to, because I think the problem we have in the body of Christ when we're talking about race or not talking about race is that we fail to recognize the opportunity to talk about our true identity. And that is that we are a colony of resident aliens living in Egypt. The United States of America, China, Russia, Syria, the United States of America, Mexico, the United States of America, these are all Egypt. This is not the promised land. This is Egypt. And we are a colony of resident aliens in this land. And if we spoke to that identity, it would be much easier for us, I think, to navigate some of these issues, because for some of us, the what's really at stake in these conversations is what we perceive as our way of life. Our way of life is at risk. And we have, which way of life are you talking about? The one that only matters in this lifetime? Or the identity, the community, the, you know, my group is being threatened. You know, we're hearing somebody say, make America great again. Which America is he referring to? Who's he talking about? Is he talking about pre-1955 USA? Is he talking about pre-1865 USA? What's he talking about? Which America is he talking about? And, you know, I don't know about you, but 1,000 years from now, we're not going to be singing the national anthem. We're going to be singing the Song of the Lamb. And we're going to be singing it with people very diverse. And we have to remind each other that when they're feeling threatened as African Americans, or feeling threatened as whites, or feeling threatened as, you know, native-born Americans, you know, remind, who are you really? Who are you really? You're part of the third race. You're part of this community that came out of the new Adam. That's what Paul's writing about in Ephesians chapter 2. You know, he created peace through his death on the cross. He created one new man. That's Adam, a new humanity. And that humanity is one in Christ. The barriers have been taken away. He's talking about Jews and Gentiles. Shouldn't we be talking about black and Hispanic and white and black and Asian and Native? Shouldn't we be talking about that? And I think we need to remind our churches, who, especially in multi-ethnic churches, who we really are. And remind us what we have in common, and what we're going to be sharing with each other 1,000 years from now, when black lives won't matter. Nobody's life is going to matter. The only life that's really going to matter is the life of the Lamb, and we're going to be singing his praises.
I think of the quote from Herman Melville. He wrote Moby Dick, and he said, "A city is as strong as its church, and its church is as strong as its pulpit." So I think as pastors, there's four levels of Bible mastery that we're called to. Devotional, familiar, where the one-year Bible comes in, topical, and then core book, where you really master a book. I think the topic is, what's the goal of the church? And I think if Paul were here, he would say that the goal is reconciliation. It's a financial term, so the way I like to say it in our church, zeros on both sides. We cool? Cool like Fonzie. Zeros on both sides. I think the central call to the disciple is listen. So it's the Revelation 1-3. Are you listening? Everyone wants to talk. Are you actually listening? So I think we need to create these multi-ethnic spaces where we listen, and especially give the mic to the people in pain. So we've done that. We have a monthly racial reconciliation meeting in our church. About 80% of our members come. Our second one, about a month ago, Clarissa, one of our African-American leaders, she goes, there's two ways of thinking, high context, low context. She's a sociologist. High context is very linear, A, B, C, D. A lot of the white people are like, you want facts. Low context, more African-American, Asian, we're circular. So when something happens next week, the circular people connect it. There's a direct line from Emmett Till right to the next one. And it's just reopening this pain. And the white people are like, oh, really? That's why you're so pissed. You know, and then we get to work and talk. And at the end, there's an awesome white brother. And he choked up. And he's like, I'm sorry that people like me have caused people who look like you so much pain. And the African American, and they hugged it out. It was real, but it's zero. You know, then they come to worship on Sunday, and they're like, "We got zeros on both sides." So I think that's honestly the role of the church, is for the people in the church to be reconcilers, and we can look and say, "Hey, we're reconciled. We're not fighting." I've never seen anyone on Facebook have a flagrant post and go, "Oh, now I see."
Yeah, exactly.
No, they just yell louder. Yeah. So I think we need to, what's the goal as pastors is it's reconciliation, and that takes a lot of hard work.
And there's not a lot of reward in that. You know, when people post on Facebook and social media, this goes back to the nuance thing, but everybody, people are playing to their what's called their effective base. So when you just go on a rant, let's say you're all for Democrats or whatever side you are, what politics, race, whatever, but people put out the stuff that they're all this passionate and they get all these likes and everybody's like, you tell them and everybody. But that's to the effective base because all you've done is push the very people you should want to win to your side or cause. You just completely push them away. It's the Einstein reaction, right? So people are playing to their effective base for likes and Facebook tweeters and pats on the back. You tell them, John, and it's only driving further division. So how do we speak with nuance and peace? And we're going to open it up right now here in a second. I'll give you a thought. So any thoughts or questions? Here's what can happen, too, real quick. As you all know, being pastors and ministry leaders, is that we've been kind of making statements and discussion. But if one or two of you do that, then we don't get a big kind of conversation. So let's try to keep it short if it's a statement, but really more like questions for interaction from the group would be good so we can get as much of your voice in the conversation as well. As you think about maybe what you might want to add to it or interject, ask a question, et cetera, I'm reminded from, you know, what Daniel was talking about and how, you know, this side or that side. When Christ taught the Beatitudes, He all the Beatitudes, in every Beatitude, you get something for what you do. All right? So, like, blessed are the mourn, what do you get? Comforted. Blessed are the meek, what do you get? You inherit the earth, right? In every Beatitude through verse 8, you get something for what you do. Then you get to verse 9, and you don't get something. You get identified with someone. And that verse says, blessed are the peacemakers. They don't get anything. It says, for you shall be called the sons of God, basically children of God, right? In other words, our identity, back to identity, you talked about the corporate identity, but our individual, both as corporate and individuals, we're never more identified with Christ than when we sow peace. That's the closest thing we can be identified with Christ on earth is as peacemakers. And this is why, you know, if I be lifted up, what? All means all in the Greek, right? So all men, all women come when we lift up Christ and we sow peace. Well, think about it. Christ wasn't speaking from notes, you know, and he set aside his power, privilege, etc. So he's just a man at that moment and he's talking. And just like me, just like all of us, you start talking about something and then you have another thought and you go with it. Isn't it interesting that right after Christ speaks about being a peacemaker, the next three verses speak of persecution? Blessed are you when they persecute you. And see, in other words, he tied persecution to peacemaking. That's what happens. So when on my Facebooks and Twitter, I walk a fine line. I'm not God's gift to this. I just practice this. But if you look at my face, you'll see how I try to navigate nuance and sow peace. And I look at some of the stuff I write and go, man, that's so good. That's so profound. And like three people like it. You know what I'm saying? Because nobody wants to like the middle ground. Well, you know what I'm saying? The peace, no one wants to like the stuff in the...
LAX.
But you know what I'm saying? They don't. No one wants to like the stuff that's kind of in the middle because it's not getting the emotional reaction. But you come on this side, man, like 100 people are going to say this. But peacemaking is difficult and it leads to persecution. People don't get it. And you can't win anybody. And then this gets to practice for us as pastors and what this is about. Because if it's about butts in the seat and how big your church is, then pick a side or another. But when you sow peace, maybe your church isn't as big as the next, or people do leave. Let me tell you, if you don't speak like this, we are always focused about how many people left because we said something. We got to think about how many people are staying because we say something and how many more people are going to come because we say something. So it's not about playing for seats. It's about playing for influence and how we navigate this nuance, sow peace, bring diverse people together. That leads to authentic relationships of transparency and trust through which we gain cross-cultural competence and we know how to pastor all people and actually export reconciliation, not racism, into our society. So with some of those thoughts that we've all shared, what are, you know, again, trying to keep it short and simple, we got about 20, 25 minutes or so. Thoughts, questions, what would you like to interact or interject to the conversation?
Where do you draw the line between not being political and yet advocating for your community and for your congregants?
That is a great question. A researcher just asked me that. Daniel, or some of you, what would you say? Where do you draw the line? Like, do we get politically active on this stuff? Do we let our actions speak? What's the line on that? You guys have any thoughts? I literally got that question, so I don't want to monopolize, but got it. Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the line is drawn. I think if you use the word as what you're going to use to sift whatever your statement's going to be or wherever your stance is going to be, this way you know you're not crushing people with your stance, because that's what, like he said, it polarizes people when you come against, right? So I think using language that is both biblical and if the heart of God, if you read it and you're like, this is exactly what God would want, so I could draw those who are angry but also draw those who are hurting. And so I think that if you look at that as the you know, what you put your comment through, it can really be either healing or encouraging or maybe even calling out, challenging to those who you know that even if they're at an extreme on their opinion, could, I think that that's the goal. When you know that somebody's that angry, but if your words cause them to say, wait, why am I this angry? That is the reaction we want. That's what we're aiming for. Or if you see somebody who's hurting and out of their hurt, there's the rage, but your words say there's hope and healing, then that's the reaction we want. So I think putting the boundary then becomes the word of God. The word of God becomes what you use to mirror or reflect whatever it is that you're going to communicate.
That's really, really good. I just adding a thing, because literally some researchers asked me that very question. For me, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, good or bad, but I look at, like, racism is ultimately a spiritual problem. So you can't legislate that out of people, and you can't educate it out of people. Now, legislation has its place for sure, right? But think about it. Look at the Voters' Rights Act. 50 years later, boom, out. The whole South has changed just like that, because, you see what I'm saying? Laws can change. And so people spend their whole lives fighting for laws. They get passed, and the next generation changes it. Education, same thing. You can't educate your rate. It's important. We need education. We need to think. But that, see, and so in other words, what is my role? It's to the who speaks to the heart? What institution? That's us. If I was speaking to a secular audience, I'd say the mosques and the temples. But in a Christian, it's the church. That's our. So I'm not a legislator. I'm not a pundit. I'm a pastor. So I've got to be there for all people. So the way I kind of look at it is I want, again, to let my action speak. This is what this church stands for by my actions. And I want to be there to speak to the heart and let the legislators legislate and the educators educate. And I'm not, again, advocating, but I have those people in my church. But collectively, we can do things. So I want to stay, in a sense, in my lane, not because I'm afraid to mix it up, but because I see how that can change. But what I know, if I can get to the human heart, that's what brings lasting change. That's my calling. If I want to be a pundit, hey, go be a pundit, you know, but I want to be a pastor. Yeah, please.
Great question. I was 23 years old, and I was at the Harambe Center in Northwest Pasadena, John Perkins. So this was 20 years ago. He was maybe mid-60s. And he opened up 2 Corinthians 5, and he said, your call is to win people to Jesus. He goes, I started Christian Community Development Association. We do so much great stuff. But he said, if I had to make a call of helping someone out of poverty and they become a yuppie, or they're still in poverty and they become a Christian, we're the church. We make Christians. So I keep hearing do good, do good, do good. And I literally have a friend, and his church basically tried to start their own Trader Joe's. And they're using enormous resources in a very uptown hipster model. We're doing good. And I go, you're the church. Make disciples. God created Trader Joe's. You don't need another one.
I think we also have to remember something important, and that is that the gospel is political. The gospel has political implications. If you ask yourself, why was Jesus crucified? Now, we would all say, shed his blood for the redemption of our sins. Is that why the Romans crucified him? Is that why the Jewish authorities handed him over? You know, why is that guy? Well, he has to die for the sins of the world. They sensed that their way of life was being challenged. They didn't believe he was who he was. But they listened to what he was saying, and they said, this message has political implications. They weren't thinking about the eternal ramifications. And I think we have to recognize when people become true disciples of Jesus, followers of Jesus who are imitating him every day, in every compartment of their compartmental lives, it is going to change our culture. And that is going to get people angry, because that's a force that, you know, nobody can control. There's no group of, what do they call the people that are constantly trying to influence politicians? I can't think of it right now.
Lobbyists.
There aren't any lobbyists. There's no money to be thrown at that. And so I think we have to recognize that, you know, when people say, don't get political, preacher, well, then I can't preach. I mean, not really. And so when we try to preach and not be political, maybe what we really mean is, how do you preach without being partisan? That's different. Not being partisan, I think, is important. You know, I have been an independent for many years because I felt like I needed to have a prophetic voice. And if I was a Democrat or a Republican and people knew that, I wouldn't have that prophetic voice. You know, but not being partisan is important. But I think being political is essential. I think it's inescapable when we're preaching the gospel.
It has an impact. Yeah. Someone else. Yes.
So I was invited to be a part of Alfred Alongo's this ceremony on Saturday and stand with other pastors behind the family. And so
do you know Lance, by any chance?
I do. Okay. Yeah. And so we had someone in our congregation who didn't like it and met with my wife and I. And I just said there's two really quick things that really helped the conversation. One was we talked about the idea of facts versus feelings. And, you know, when a husband and a wife have an argument and she talks about her feelings and he brings up facts,
I don't know anything about that.
How does she feel? And so I felt like that was really helpful to our conversation. Like, she's like, his hands weren't up. And we're like, stop. Who cares about if his hands were up? We're not talking about this. We're talking about this. How do they feel? And then the second thing we brought up, which is why it's so important to have a multi-ethnic congregation, great book, by the way, is that when you know people that share the same skin. So we said to her, here's the deal. You know this guy in our church who has a son with autism that is 6'3", 250 pounds? He's scared right now. And for her, the feelings and the understanding that facts are not the important thing for her right now, but that this man and his wife are afraid for their son who can't understand when a police officer tells him something, that helped her a lot. So that's just our experience.
Very good. Excellent. Great points. Someone else? Thoughts? Questions? Yes.
I think just taking this to like a kind of global level, we know globalism is you know something that's real for us now, and I think I'd love to just hear more thoughts and ideas about specifically nationalism playing into this, because even with a multi-ethnic, multicultural church, everyone still has countries of origin, or if this is their country of origin, there's a sense of there's still brothers and sisters of ours around the world that we turn deaf ears to or blind eyes to. What are some ways that maybe you guys or others that you know have taken this same issue global and kind of looked at it from even a multicultural, okay, we've done this, we've created this multicultural, multi-ethnic church, and we want to be better and better at it. But even for us, how do we become better in a global sense of remembering our brothers and sisters, taking a stance of humility, because I see us still as Americans being a dominant group or thinking of ourselves as a dominant group. So we've been successful in those churches over there or in some other part of the world, and they're not as smart or wise or great as we are. And so how do we battle that? How have you guys done that?
Great question. I think it's all about exposure and actually going there. You know, so our church in Long Beach, we're a church planting church, so we've planted three churches in Hong Kong. And we're there, you know, the Umbrella Movement. So the Umbrella Movement, two Novembers ago, was fighting the Beijing powers. And we learned so much from the 20-year-old activists. We were there. We literally fly 16 hours. We land in Dallas, and the Ferguson ruling just happened like 2 hours before. And we're like contrasting these, and I'm like, these are the 10 things they're doing so well. So, but because we have friends there, I try to really have a learning posture. Like they, what's happening in Asia is unbelievable. They look at us and they're like, hey, we'll come and train you.
You know, sometimes in terms of thinking about multi-ethnic ministry, we forget that some of the strongest opposition to multi-ethnic churches are ethnic minority groups. And part of it is, again, living in a dominant group that many people wonder, well, all these people coming, they must think this is the greatest country on earth. And I try to help them understand, especially the dominant group people, that many people come from Latin America in particular, which I'm more familiar with. They're not coming here because this is the promised land. This is Egypt. They left the promised land. There's no schools. There's no medicine. There's no food. Just like Joseph, Jacob and his sons, they went to Egypt and they want to live in Goshen. They want to live in an isolated pocket because they're trying to preserve something they believe is better than what's here. So they're preserving a better language, a better set of cultural values and commitments, and they want their children to, you know, to not become like Egyptians. And so we have a difficult time, and especially if you're working with, you know, multi-generations of Koreans or multi-generations of Hispanics or Chinese, they're struggling with their kids because their kids think this is the promised land, they think it's Egypt, and they don't understand why their parents seem so committed to preserving, you know, their homeland in Egypt, and why they seem to be resistant to multi-ethnic churches. They, like I mentioned before, they also have to be reminded, usually not by someone in the dominant group, that they left Egypt, and this is also Egypt. But again, that's hard when the people that they're around who call themselves Christians act like Egyptians.
That's a great question. We have time just for one more thing and a final thought, whoever's going to ask that. But I look at that a little bit differently in this sense. Because I left a, you know, mega white Republican suburban church with works all over the world. But why I'm saying that is that I'm in the urban center of Little Rock, highest violent crime rate, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I know how the people in the American South, in my city, in the urban community, look at all that. They're like, you send your money and your mission across an ocean, but you won't even go across the street. So in our church, we have missionaries, et cetera, but we focused on that community. It's an, you know, anomaly. If you're a suburban, maybe it's a little different. But there's a lot. There has been a big missions thrust in the dominant evangelical church for many years. But we haven't listened, we haven't learned, we haven't gone across the street so much. And so, it's a both and, obviously. Yeah, it's a both
walk
and.
Walk across the street.
Huh?
Walk across the street.
That's right, yeah, walk across. Yeah, that's right. So anyway, I'm just saying, but it's much easier. That's what they say. See, the idea of building bridges, like we're going to build a bridge, you know, but then we get to come home and wash our hands and take a shower. And so, you know, I don't want to build bridges. I want to be the community, you know, and mix it up. So I want to be as strong home, and again, it gives credibility, as I am, you know, whatever we can do across the ocean. Last thought, question, anybody else? Yes.
Earlier, Josh Naomi talked about credibility, multi-ethnic credibility, and so they talked about the multi-ethnicity that they experience in their own personal marriage, because Josh is Salvadorian, Naomi's Mexican, and then Dr. Rodriguez showed us a picture of his family and that he's Latino and his wife is Caucasian. I am African American. My wife is a white Jewish woman from the northwestern suburbs of Chicago. And so how is when you're a multi-ethnic family, we're talking about multi-ethnic credibility, and I don't know who else this affects, but as someone who's entering the multi-ethnic movement, is that something that gives us credibility because my wife and I are a multi-ethnic couple? Do we leverage that, or do we have instant credibility, or does that give us no credibility and we still have to earn multi-ethnic credibility and we just don't get that for being that and actually living that life? And Josh and Naomi kind of talked about it, and Dr. Rodriguez kind of alluded to it earlier. So could you guys talk about whether, and for anybody else who's who's in a multi-ethnic marriage, if that's something you leverage, celebrate, promote, or is it just something that you just don't talk about, but it's evident in your, obviously in your ministry and marriage?
Both of y'all can answer, because I know you're married to a white woman.
So earlier we talked about, in talks about credibility, we talked about consistency. So, you know, when I married Noemi, you know, clearly, you know, it's a Samaritan Jew kind of thing between Mexicans and Salvadorians. And she made it clear, she's Jewish, I'm the Samaritan. You know,
so,
right. So we just celebrated 15 years of marriage. We dated for almost 20, been together for 22 years. We dated 7 years, so 22 years together. I spent a few days in her parents' hometown in Mexico this year. And I am clearly different to every Latino in Carreras, Durango, Mexico. Even though I speak their language, I even cook dinner for them. I felt like such an outsider. But what I've come to learn about credibility implies trust, implies I feel safe enough to say you have credibility. And I think what gives us that, in no matter what, you know, right off the bat, when you meet a stranger, there's no trust, there's no safety. It's this word consistency, you know, and they don't know me. I look different. But what they look into our marriage, they look at the consistency of 15 years, 22 years together. And I believe that bleeds into how we lead our church. When we showed up as church planners, here's those that weren't Hispanic. They didn't see Mexican and Salvadorian. They just saw Hispanics. But our consistency to loving our community, our city, gave us, at some point, it shifted from the new church planners to pastors that have credibility in the city. So I think what we have to aim for is the consistency. You know, so as you guys embrace this new season of church planting, I think it helps. It's definitely a plus that you guys are multi-ethnic and that you know, like, I think that in itself lets people know, okay, they've moved past racism. They married someone who looks completely different. But I think the consistency as you impact your community is going to be that consistency piece.
Yeah, and no doubt you've experienced this. You know, you'll lose credibility too. In a multiracial, or, you know, I hate using that term, but we know it's a social contract. Construct, but that's the language you use. Just like there's no such thing as a Hispanic, but we use the term. Okay, so my guess is that among some African Americans, you've lost credibility because you married a white girl. I've lost credibility among some Latinos because I married a white girl. My wife has lost some credibility because she married a Hispanic guy, and so that's a reality. But we also have gained a voice that we didn't have before. My wife, I wish she was here because it's been incredible. When we're in situations where we're asked to come in and speak about Hispanic Anglo dynamics, and somebody on the dominant group says something, and I want to respond, and my wife, you know, they won't even married 22 years. We've been married almost 40 years. They're newbies, okay? And we have a very diverse family. You know, we've got Chinese and white and everybody in our family now. But my wife will take the mic and she has the ability to say to the dominant group, here's what I've seen as not only the wife of this man, our children are all café con leche. They all look like me. And she always says, I don't understand why none of them look like me. And I just say, weak genes. That's what it is. But because her children all look like me, she has also seen and observed what's happened to them. And so when she speaks up, you know, she has a prophetic voice that I don't have, you know, and goes, man, I don't know what you people are talking about. My wife, wait, let me talk, you know, and just like, okay. And so that happens again. And it's an attraction too. I mean, there are people that come into our church in Hollywood. We have, you know, probably half a dozen mixed race families. You see the little, you know, light skinned girl with kinky hair, you know, and people, there's more and more. I mean, like 7% in the last census of mixed race people. So there's probably some here as well. They walk into a church and they go, I don't have to choose here. People understand. And so you're going to attract certain people and, of course, lose credibility with others. That's just the nature of the beast.
So I'm half Korean, half Dutch. And then my wife is Japanese American, fourth generation. So if you know the Asian history, that's a miracle.
Yeah.
And the thing I would say is I think it's helpful. The character I think about is Barnabas. And Barnabas was bicultural. But I think as pastors and church planters, what I think Josh and Naomi are really getting at is spiritual authority. They're not going to be drawn to the church because, you know, of who we are. It's because of the Lord's work, and that this is a church that repents into the word, repents into prayer, repents into real fellowship, repents into the meals. You know, so Jesus, when he did cross-cultural ministry 63 times, every single time, Samaritan, Jewish leader, whoever, his spiritual authority base is who sent him. So 63 times, I am sent by the Father. I am sent by the Father. So I think we need to be anchored in the sentness of God.
Well, listen, that's really great. I am married to a white woman who's half Greek, and that, so I don't have any of that kind of credibility, right? In other words, I don't have that experience. But what I will say, and this is kind of a good way to close, is that in what you have, whether you're married to someone different than you or you go to church with someone different than you, is divided by faith showed that the primary relationships Christians form or with people they go to church with. So when you're mixing it up with diverse people in a local church or in a marriage, what you're gaining, of course, is you're developing cross-cultural relationships, right? As in a marriage or just in my church with me. And then from that, those cross-cultural relationships, you gain cross-cultural competence, right? All the things, they've gained competence, right? You gain competence in this culture, that. And then that's what gets leveraged, is that competence then to advance the gospel in an increasingly diverse society. So it gives you credibility only to the measure of your confidence, right? And only to the measure of the gospel-centric discipleship and stuff. But that's what you have. By the way, the 1 in 20 marriages were interracial in 1960. And at the last count, which I think was about 4 or 5 years ago, it was 1 in 7. So when by, you know, just taking stats that 43% of millennials are people of color, 1 in 2 kids under 18 in 2018 will not be white. 2042, you know, the stat quoted often, 1 in 2 people not white in America. Think about the instances then, right? And with your time about Daniel, 7%. So think it's going to be more and more. Maybe by 2030, 2040, maybe it's 1 in 4 marriages. And what's happening is that through interracial marriage, cross-cultural adoption, the diversification of our society, all this is coming to bear because everything's getting personal now. So when you're, for instance, you're a white couple and your kid marries, maybe it's a white guy and marries a black woman. Now you've got a biracial child, right? And for the first time, you're 65 years old, you're a white grandfather, you walk into your church and you ask the question, why are all the dolls in the nursery white? You never saw that. You never thought twice about that. But now my grandkid is biracial and I'm thinking about that. And the pictures of Jesus, everybody's white, you know. So as all these things are happening from interracial marriages to cross-cultural adoption to the biracial children, it's becoming personal to Christians, and that's informing the church. And that's a final segue to say this. That's why, though, we have to be ahead of this and at the theological level. If you know anything about me and my writing ministry, it's always about theology, starting there. This isn't political correctness. You know, changing demographics, this is for the sake of the gospel. It's theologically, it's biblically right, it's the hope of the gospel. And we need to know that, because if we adjust the church to fit the demographics, that's like shifting sand. We have to align the church to the theological mooring that Jews and Gentiles are called to walk, work, and worship God together as one. And this becomes the credible message of God's love for all people that becomes attractive to the gospel in a world that is divided and looking for faith, peace, hope, and love, right? And so even when we think about works, we talked about the good works that we can do, whether it's political or social justice, etc. And John, you kind of alluded to this with Dr. Perkins. You can do all these works, but if there is not love, it's your noisy gongs and clanging cymbals. This is the whole point of 1 Corinthians 13. It has nothing to do with a man loving a woman. It has everything to do with Jews and Gentiles loving one another in a local church. And he says that's the most excellent way. To what? Advance the credible witness in a diverse society.